Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, December 22nd, 2016. A surprise visit to Juba from the President of Uganda.
They fought for total peace and self-determination, and I would appeal to the transitional government headed by the President to stop all actions involving insecurity.
And refugees tell emotional stories of their families being reunited after fleeing South Sudan.
It is too emotional. It's excitement, of course. Tears of joy, of course, I expected. So these people, they become excited. Sometimes they go an extra mile and say, what can we give you in return?
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni made a surprise visit today to Juba, where he urged the transitional government of national unity to take concrete steps to immediately end insecurity across the country so that people focus on general elections in 2018, as stipulated in the Agreement on Resolution of Conflict in South Sudan. Speaking to reporters in J1 after a closed-door session with President Salva Kiir, President Museveni said the people of South Sudan deserve peace.
They fought for total peace and self-determination, and I would appeal to the transitional government headed by the president and all the other stakeholders to stop all actions involving insecurity so that the people focus on elections as soon as possible. Because that's what the people of South Sudan fought for. And any other issues that need to be handled in order to have free and fair elections should be handled. That is my prayer for the people of South Sudan, to regain their sovereignty through the vote, because the elections could not be held because of fighting.
Museveni says, unfortunately, South Sudanese still do not control their destiny.
All fighting should stop so that the people of South Sudan regain their power. Because now they don't have the power. The power is with the people with the guns. Now the people of South Sudan need to regain their power.
For his part, President Kiir said he was pleased to welcome Mr. Museveni to Juba.
We are honored by this visit, and because it gives us energy to move forward and to get advices from him. He has a very rich experience that we can gain from him. We have covered several issues of bilateral importance, and we will take all the advices he has given to me, and we will do with it.
Fighting continues along the two main highways that lead to and from Uganda and South Sudan. The South Sudan Army is trying to flesh out pockets of forces loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar, who fled the country shortly after a surge in fighting in July in the capital. Most retail businessmen and women in South Sudan are Ugandans. Many of them lost their property during the July fighting in Juba. The South Sudan government had said it has agreed to pay Ugandan businesses some $40 million to compensate them for lost or looted property during the fighting. South Sudanese fleeing the conflict in their country say when fighting usually breaks out, people are forced to run for their lives, oftentimes with members of the same family fleeing in different directions. In some cases, a family member is never seen again, but in many cases, family members meet up again. But it could take months or even years before they are reunited, usually in a second country. Simon Peter Apiku files from Kampala.
The Uganda Red Cross says it has reunited more than 200 families at the Bidibidi camp since the camp was established in August. Some of the reunions involve South Sudanese husbands and wives, or parents and their children, or brothers and sisters who fled in different directions when gunmen raided their villages. Red Cross official Abdu Segawa is in charge of tracing and reuniting separated families in Yumbe District. He says his organization has documented hundreds of cases of children arriving at the camp unaccompanied.
It is estimated that over 65% are women and children. Out of 65%, you may realize that 75% of the 65% are children. So out of the 75% children whom we are receiving, basically around 20% are children with no accompaniment.
The Red Cross relies on a network of volunteers inside the settlement who try to trace the families of those who turn up alone or missing certain family members. These assistants also help reunite separated families. Segawa says while the organization has little difficulty obtaining information from adults, getting similar information about family history from minors can often pose problems.
These children who are below 13 and 8 and 5, sometimes they fail to express the whereabouts of their father, their family members, and we find it really, really, really very big challenging to us because we are basing from the information they are giving us to start the tracing, to initiate the tracing.
He says there is a high number of children waiting to be reunited with their family members at the camp.
Currently, Bidi alone, there's just a population of over 90 unaccompanied children who are scattered within the five zones of Bidi, refugee settlement.
Segawa says they have heard success stories, particularly with adults separated from their loved ones. Helen Sitima's family is among the more than 200 families at the Bidi camp that the Red Cross has reunited over the past 3 months. Sitima is a mother of 6 children who all fled from Ye in September as government soldiers were fighting rebels in the town. Speaking in Arabic, Sitima says she escaped with 5 of her children but did not know what happened to her 17-year-old daughter who was pregnant at the time they fled their village.
Heavy fighting one night in Ye town forced us to separate. I ran separately. My daughter fled her own way and her husband ran in a different direction.
Sitima says she later found out her daughter fled into the bush while her husband headed in a different direction. She says even as she and her other children walked towards the Ugandan border, she was deeply troubled about the pregnant daughter she left behind. Sitima says she feared the worst.
I never stopped thinking if she was still alive or they had killed her. I also wondered whether she was somewhere looking for me.
Sitima's daughter, Jacqueline Tabu, gave birth in the bush a few days after she became separated from her family. Tabu, who has since been reunited with her family, says she remained in hiding for a month as the violence intensified. Speaking in Arabic, Tabu says nobody in the bush she was hiding with had had a real meal in 4 days, all while she was caring for her one-month-old baby.
If you travel with children, the journey to Uganda border on foot can take up to a week. But if you do not have children, you can reach the border in about 4 days.
In Uganda, Tabu and fellow refugees were taken to the Rhino camp in Arua district, where she immediately began searching for her mother and siblings. As a child mother living on her own, Tabu attracted the attention of the Uganda Red Cross.
The Uganda Red Cross official asked me why I was living alone and inquired the whereabouts of my mother. I told them that I was informed that my mother was somewhere in Bidi camp. They searched for my mother until they found her and made arrangements for me to join her at Bidi settlement.
The reunion happened a month later at the Bidi settlement in Yumbe district. Tabu says when she saw her mother and siblings again, it was very emotional. Sitima says she was overwhelmed with joy to see her daughter and meet her grandson for the first time.
I am so delighted that we have been reunited. If we are going to die, we shall die together.
Segawa says reunited families like Sitima's are often so overcome with happiness they offer to reward Red Cross officials even when they know they have nothing of value to give.
It is too emotional, it is excitement, of course. Tears of joy, of course, are expected. So these people, they become excited. Sometimes they go an extra mile and say, what can we give you in return?
While Sitima and Tabu are pleased to be together again, mother and daughter say their search for loved ones is not over yet. Sitima has never heard from her husband since leaving South Sudan. Tabu says she too has no information on the whereabouts of her husband. Both mother and daughter hope a Red Cross worker will one day turn up on their doorstep providing information about their spouses. For VOA News, I'm Simon Peter Apiku in Kampala.
The wife of former First Vice President Riek Machar and a prominent member of the SPLM in opposition political bureau says the problems that South Sudan faced this year could be traced back to the founding of the country. In an interview with VOA Straight Talk Africa yesterday, Angelina Teng said President Kiir's lack of political leadership is largely to blame for the humanitarian crisis in the country. Teng says the country's political troubles began in 2005 during the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. She says she and other politicians had a hard time agreeing on a constitution that would guide the people of South Sudan.
And thereafter, the next casualty was actually the political space. So there was no space for dialogue, to discuss issues. When people try to raise this, that we must discuss the future of the country and how we can actually embed it, the aspiration of the people of South Sudan that they fought for so long in our institutional system of governance, then it became an issue. And our president didn't take it lightly. He took offense to when people descended.
Teng says the lack of dialogue in the SPLM a decade ago is partly to blame for the country's current state of affairs.
And immediately when we started to discuss our transitional constitution, this is when the disagreement started to surface even within the ruling party and especially between the president and his vice then. And this is when we were raising issues of concerns with regards to the need to restructuring the government institutions that were used to oppress us, to improve on the interim constitution, to institute a system of governance that would devolve power to the people.
Looking back at the process of building the country from the ground up, Teng said when her husband was vice president, South Sudanese were not allowed to openly discuss issues like how much power the president would have under the constitution and the checks and balances that should be put in place to ensure that public institutions worked for the interest of the people.
Dr. Riek Machar was the vice president, but I can tell you when we navigated from 2005 up to 2011, we had to navigate very carefully to ensure that actually the referendum is not jeopardized. So within our ruling party, the SPLM, whenever there are issues with regards to internal democracy and what have you and whatnot, we tend to kind of play them down because we do not want to sabotage.
Teng says the crisis can be averted if South Sudanese and IGAD leaders start listening to the people of South Sudan and work to revive the 2015 peace deal.
You know, when you undermine the voice of the people, the next thing is you find that, violence replaces peaceful democratic processes. So we're urging IGAD, please don't get fatigued. Don't get tired. Peace in South Sudan is peace in your country, is peace in the region, and peace in the whole world.
That was Angelina Teng speaking yesterday with host Shaka Sali on VOA Straight Talk Africa. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. University of Juba lecturers who were fired last week fight back. Find out how when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
if you could choose one nice thing to do for your family, what would it be?
Well, the nicest thing I think I can do for my family right now is to give them enough money so that my mom and dad don't have to work again because they're old.
I'll give them comfort, because comfort is the most thing everybody should get. Because when you have comfort, you ease off stress.
That thing I would do for them is education. I will offer them education because that's the best thing you can offer to somebody, because it enables that person to get up and make a choice for his or herself.
I would choose to bring my family together, to be in unity, because I know that when the family is in unity, there is happiness, there is love.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Juba University Academic Staff Association are downplaying a decision by the university's Vice Chancellor, Professor John Akech, to suspend five lecturers for casting votes of no confidence against the Vice Chancellor. The university's lecturers are demanding that the Vice Chancellor be removed for acting unilaterally. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
Out of the University of Juba's 61 lecturers, 51 cast votes of no confidence last week against the university vice-chancellor Professor John Akech. Only four lecturers voted in favor of him, while six votes were counted as invalid. The vice-chancellor immediately suspended five lecturers after the vote. Among those suspended is the president of the academic staff, Philip Finish Apollo. Apollo says the lecturers met today to talk about what happened and their next course of action.
The meeting resolved that the suspension was done wrongly. It has not followed the legal procedure. And the General Assembly, in strong terms, denounced this suspension, which are not properly done.
He says the teaching staff has agreed to write a letter to the chairman of the council, Professor Moses Machar, asking the vice-chancellor to reverse his decision. Apollo says the move to suspend them is especially egregious now, at a time when many South Sudanese students are trying to get into the University of Juba.
Generally, it will demoralize them, because to suspend senior academic staff, for example, somebody like Dr. Bully, who spent over 30 years in the university, to be suspended just like that without, really or genuine reasons, is really very, very unfortunate. So this will definitely affect students psychologically.
He says the lecturers are demanding an immediate reinstatement of their colleagues and the removal of the vice-chancellor.
If they are reinstated, still the vice-chancellor has to go. This is the position. It will not change anything. What is important here is just to reinstate these five academic members, and the position of removing the vice-chancellor remains the same. Nothing changed.
Apollo says if the vice-chancellor refuses to reverse his decision or step down, the university's lecturers will go on strike.
That will be the time whereby people will lay down their tools. But we believe that he will not refuse to move. If there is a decision from the leadership for him to go, he will go.
The University of Juba is South Sudan's oldest university. It was established in 1975. More than 10,000 students are registered at the university. It has six colleges, six schools, four specialized centers, and two institutes. In June, Juba University lecturers went on strike for a month because of unpaid salaries and allowances for 3 months. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
In 2015 alone, nearly 730,000 immigrants from around the world became American citizens, each with his or her own path to the official ceremony, recognizing and celebrating their new status. In this report, VOA's Adam Phillips takes us to a typical citizenship ceremony in New York City.
Please rise for our national anthem.
Oh, take us, you see, by the God's It's mid-morning in a huge federal office building in downtown Manhattan, and 137 people from 35 countries of origin are standing together listening to what in a few minutes will become their own national anthem, too. Katie DeHasek is a public affairs officer with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services.
No matter where we have the ceremonies, whether it's just in our office like today or at really inspirational spots like Statue of Liberty, people are always experiencing a whole range of emotions. Feel grateful, feel excited, feel relieved. They're Americans by choice. It's really an honor to be able to watch it.
Bahamas, Bangladesh, People's Republic of China, Dominican Republic.
There is important symbolism in the citizenship ceremony. While everyone is seated, the master of ceremonies calls out the name of each of the nations represented here today. When citizen candidates hear the name of their own country of origin, they stand up to applause. What mere moments ago had been 37 isolated groups of people becomes one group standing together on the brink of American citizenship. As it says on every American coin, e pluribus unum, out of many, one. The oath of citizenship, sworn with right hands raised, completes the transformation, as we hear in this highly abbreviated montage.
Repeat after me. I hereby declare on oath that I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America, against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I'll bear true faith and allegiance to the same. So help me God. Congratulations.
To top it off, President Obama personally welcomes the assembly into the national family by video. Here is an edited excerpt.
It's an honor and a privilege to call you a fellow citizen of the United States of America. This is now officially your country, your home to protect, to defend, and to serve through active and engaged citizenship. Together, we are a nation united not by any one culture or ethnicity or ideology, but by the principles of opportunity, equality, and liberty that are enshrined in our founding documents.
Soon, the personalized official certificates of citizenship are conferred, and these brand new citizens are free to take souvenir selfies with their friends and families in front of the American flag. Aissata, a traditional Muslim from Guinea, seems visibly relieved.
Yeah, I'm happy today.
Was it a long road to get here? Was it hard to become a citizen?
Yes.
Anthony Andrews, who came to the U.S. from Jamaica in 2002, has walked that long road himself.
It just get better than this, you know? It's nothing but pleasure right now, I must say.
Jessica Mendez, a U.S. citizen originally from Mexico, is here to support her best friend's mother. What does it mean to her to become a citizen?
Oh, my God. More freedom to be able to come and go to her country as she pleases. She feels secure now.
Mamadou Ouattara, originally from the Ivory Coast, became a U.S. citizen some years ago. And his wife has just become a citizen, too.
I'm very, very happy my wife gonna be a citizen today. Mm-hmm. She'll be able to go to school. She'll be able to work. And we're going to have a very beautiful life. So we said, thank you, America. No matter what happened, we still say, thank you, America.
Gratitude and commitment are sentiments that all Americans, native or foreign-born, and of every idea and political stripe, can readily share. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
The mainstream media has been blamed for not reporting conflicts accurately. Some South Sudanese in the diaspora say some international media outlets fueled the conflict in South Sudan by reporting propaganda from the warring parties. Professor Matthew Lariche of Memorial University in Canada, Goithon Leek, a South Sudanese diaspora member in Nairobi, and Gaetano Dimo, a civil society activist in Canada, join John Tanza to discuss how the mainstream media performed during South Sudan's 3 years of conflict.
Goithon Leek, what is the contribution of the mainstream media in addressing hate speech?
I don't think its contribution to these hate speeches is not that much compared to the social media. Actually, there might be a few instances, a countable time, But to me, I don't think it's as much deeper as the social media. Social media has contributed a lot.
Gaetano, I mean, your main source of information here in North America is the mainstream media. How is the mainstream media contributing to this issue of hate speech?
To a certain degree, there are some certain outlets of mainstream media, they contributed to that, but for the most part, the majority of them who abide by the ethical rules of communication, they don't do that. Now, the only problem that I look on it, like the mainstream media, sometimes they get their information inaccurate because they don't have reporters on the ground to feed them with right information. At the same time, even the reporters who are in the ground, they don't have the freedom to report freely, because, you know, they are not given that freedom. So most of the time we end up getting inaccurate information.
Professor Matthew, what is your experience?
Well, you know, I think inaccuracies, certainly, you know, there are many cases of inaccuracies. You know, there's lots of good reporting that comes out. There's lots of good reporting that gets ignored and left aside. So the editorial side of things in terms of the mainstream media, is a part of this. I think the tone and the way of communicating in terms of the mainstream media, partly because their audience Western people in terms of who they see as the consumers of their product. So, you know, the way of describing even simple aspects of a conflict or a confrontation, they very much rely on simplistic stories about, you know, so and so the Dinka or so and so the Nuer, or, you know, they quite quickly frame things in that simplistic narrative, and then that kind of structure feeds the storyline and feeds understandings and reactions by everybody, you know, both in the domestic context and internationally. And of course, if you're somebody who's feeling angry and an incident has occurred and tensions are high and international actors and mainstream media are framing things a certain way and you're hearing that, it adds credence to your grievance and to your issue. And justification for whatever action you choose to make. So there is a lack of care, I think, in terms of the way mainstream media reports. But it's not necessarily the fault of journalists or individuals, because part of it is also the system of mainstream media now, where, you know, the time span that you have to investigate a story to research what's going on is so narrow, and you need to, and everything needs to be sensationalized and driven so that something is hooked. The story, you know, hooks people's interest and gets readers, and really people who are actively reporting are not resourced well, whether they're international journalists or local journalists. So I think there are major problems with relying on mainstream media.
We've been listening to Professor Matthew Lariche of Memorial University in Canada, Goithon Leek, a South Sudanese diaspora member in Nairobi, and Gaetano Dumo, a civil society activist from Canada, sharing their views on how South Sudanese traditional authorities can help to address hate speech among South Sudanese. You can hear all 14 segments of our special series on hate speech by visiting our website at voanews.com/South Sudan. And that's our show for this Thursday. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.